kinds of megaliths in the valley, one being very large stone cisterns called kalamba, precisely cut and hollowed out within, and in some cases weighing more than a ton, the other being figures like Watu Palindo, weighing up to 20 tons. For 2 days, we tramp along the borders of waterlogged rice fields and on rough tracks through forests. At one point, we come to a statue lying on its back in the midst of a clearing, staring up at the heavens. A little later, we find another, also on its back, lying in the midst of a river. Both show the same hand and arm positions as Watu Palindo, the sage. A third figure, with weird fish-like features, is buried up to its neck in deep water rice. A fourth figure stands lonely on a ridge, gazing at a distant range of mountains. The frustrating thing is that nothing, really nothing at all, is known about these megaliths. Who created them? When? Why? All is mystery. Hobbits, Dragons, and the Flood. From the Bada Valley, we make a long road journey to Toraja in South Sulawesi. All journeys are long here. Sulawesi is the 11th largest island in the world. We spend a couple of days in the area. There is an eerie cult of the dead, which involves digging up the bodies of the deceased once a year, dressing them in new clothes, combing their mouldering hair, tidying their coffins, and reinterring them. Lifelike effigies of the deceased are also placed in rock-cut shrines high up in cliff faces, and there are caves full of bones. What we've come here to see are not the dead, but megaliths. This being Toraja, however, the megaliths are all about the dead, and unlike in other parts of the world, and indeed other parts of Indonesia, they aren't relics of a remote and forgotten past, but part of a living, active, fully functional cult. We visit Bori Parinding, a site dominated by a cluster of tall, needle-like menhirs that might be transplanted without difficulty to any one of a dozen locations in Europe and confidently dated to 5,000 years old or more. Yet Bori Parinding is just 200 years old. The oldest megalith here was erected in 1817. Each one is a monument to a deceased Torajan notable, and new menhirs are still quarried and put in place every year. Those cut from andesite are mined from a nearby deposit and shaped with hammers and metal chisels. A local elder shows me how it's done. Those cut from limestone, weighing in some cases an estimated 15 tons, are brought from a quarry 5 kilometers away by teams of hundreds of men working in shifts for more than a week who haul the menhirs to the site on wooden rollers. Indonesia, I'm beginning to realize, is a land where ancient traditions live on in fascinating ways, and the connection to the remote past is ever present. That's a realization that's brought home to me all the more strongly on our next stop, the island of Flores. We reach it by driving all day from Toraja to Makassar, where we catch a flight to Bali, and thence via Komodo, famous for its large predatory lizards known as Komodo dragons, to Ende, the chief city of Flores, a city with a population of just 60,000. In recent times, Flores has attracted fame for the discovery on the island of the remains of Homo floresiensis, an extinct species of human that stood, in adulthood, just 1.1 meters, 3.5 feet tall, and has accordingly been dubbed the Hobbit. I'll have more to say about these creatures later, but as I land at Ende after that stopover in Komodo, I can't help reflecting that Indonesia is truly a mythical place, the only country in the world today where dragons and hobbits are not the stuff of fantasy, but of science. Flores is charming, far out on the edge of the world, simple, lacking in many modern conveniences, but with a sweet, gentle spirit. We base ourselves in the town of Bajawa, and in the couple of days we spend here, we visit a number of villages where the tidy bamboo and thatch houses are built upon and around extensive megalithic monuments. In the village of Bena, about 16 kilometers from Bajawa, with distant glimpses of the Savu Sea and of Mount Inari, we're shown around by Joseph, a venerable elder of 88 years. The village has 2 parallel rows of houses, with the high thatched roofs, triangular in cross-section, that are characteristic of the area. The houses are separated by a long and wide public space, filled with an incredible assortment of menhirs and dolmens, which, as with the menhirs of Taraja, would not look out of place if they were excavated from Neolithic strata in Europe. Joseph tells us that the dolmens aren't tombs, as is usually the case in Europe, but altars used by members of each of the different clans resident in the village. From time to time, buffalo sacrifices are carried out on the altars in honor of deceased notables, and the megaliths have a function in aiding communication with the departed and in connecting the supernatural and earthly realms. Such ideas don't syncretize well with Christianity, which is also a part of daily life here. Indeed, at the far end of the village, there is a shrine to the Virgin Mary. Joseph tells us that dolmens and menhirs were still being erected when he was a young man, but that this is no longer done and the tradition is dying out. When I ask him about the origins of the megalithic cult, however, he tells me a remarkable story. Our ancestors, he says, came here in a ship around 12,000 years ago during a great flood. Indeed, it seems that the whole village is laid out in commemoration of that ship, which was propelled not by sails, but by an engine. Joseph shows me a megalithic chamber, roughly in the middle of the village, that symbolizes the place where the engine house was located in the original ship. I ask him where all the megaliths come from, and he tells me that they were brought from 20 kilometers away on the slopes of Mount Inari and moved into position by special powers possessed by the ancestors. He adds that an American scholar, a certain Professor Smith, has confirmed the story. This mention of the name of a foreign researcher, whose identity and bona fides I was not subsequently able to establish, raises the nagging possibility in my mind that the whole tale might not be of indigenous origin at all, but might be an imported concoction, a fantasy even, which Joseph believes to be true. Certainly we are not told the same story in other megalithic villages of Flores. At Wagobaru, for example, elders spoke of a giant called Dake, who was so huge that he had single-handedly carried the megaliths down from the slopes of Mount Inari. What all the accounts seem to have in common, however, is a whiff of wonder and magic. Queen of the Southern Ocean. Leaving Flores, we fly from Ende via Denpasar in Bali to the city of Palembang in Sumatra, then make a 2-day road journey from east to west across South Sumatra. Again, our focus is megaliths, but most of what we see in the form of large sculpted human and anthropomorphic figures shows the influence of Hindu and Buddhist art, and thus is certainly not prehistoric. It's only when we come to a coffee plantation in the mountains near the city of Pagaralam that we find something really interesting. A series of gigantic megalithic subterranean chambers, several of which are painted with swirling designs in striking colors of red ochre and black charcoal, amidst which animal figures can be discerned. No dating work has been done on them, but similar chambers such as West Kennet Longbarrow in England or Gavrinis in Carnac, Brittany, are more than 5,000 years old, while the painted caves of France and Spain are even older, going back 33,000 years in the case of Chauvet, for example. The Sumatran paintings have much in common with those of Southern Europe, being profoundly visionary, with characteristic entoptic patterns indicating that the artists were shamans who had experienced and were depicting visions seen in deeply altered states of consciousness, likely induced by psychedelic plants or fungi. We drive on to the city of Bengkulu and fly from there to Jakarta, the massive, sprawling Indonesian capital on the island of Java. Jakarta is like a giant octopus. Once it has entangled you in the tentacles of its clogged roadways, it is extremely difficult to get free. Late the same evening, however, we eventually reach our next destination, Pelabuhan Ratu, on the southwest coast of Java, facing the Indian Ocean. It's only an overnight stop. In the morning, we'll be going to another megalithic site inland. But it turns out that Pelabuhan Ratu, which means Harbour of the Queen, is of interest in its own right. Indeed, the Samudra Beach Hotel where we're staying has a room, room 308, that no one is allowed to reserve because it's permanently set aside for the Queen of the Southern Ocean, a kind of sea fairy or goddess who rules over a submerged city and occasionally appears on land to interact with mortal humans. Obviously, I'm interested in submerged cities, particularly submerged cities around the islands of Indonesia, which were all part of a giant continent known to geologists as Sunda Land that was above water and connected to the rest of Southeast Asia until about 11,600 years ago. When sea levels rose cataclysmically at the end of the Younger Dryas, this region lost more habitable land, including a massive low-lying plain, than almost anywhere else on Earth. Although it's close to midnight, I therefore insist on paying a visit to room 308, which is fully decorated and furnished as a royal boudoir, complete with imaginative paintings of Najai Lara Kidul, the Queen of the Southern Ocean. It's a romantic story, and who knows, there may be something to it. Certainly no attempt to uncover the mysterious origins of human civilization can afford to ignore the rapid drowning of Sunda Land, which was fertile and well-watered with four major river systems before it was flooded. Indeed, it's because of this, and because much of the flooding occurred around 11,600 years ago, precisely the date that Plato gives for the submergence of Atlantis, that our travelling companion, geologist Dani Natwijaja, believes Indonesia is Atlantis and has made such efforts to investigate the extraordinary megalithic pyramid of Gunung Padang. Gunung Padang, which I first visited in December 2013 and described in Chapter 2, is 120 kilometres north of us, and we'll be going back there at the end of this trip. Before we do, however, there's one more site we want to see. It's called Tugu Gede, near the village of Chengkuk, 20 kilometres into the mountains north of Pelabuhan Ratu. We set off in the morning, on another of those precipitous and slightly alarming roads that Indonesia has so many of, but once again, the trip is worth it. We go as far as the car can take us and then have a long walk, first through a village in the midst of banana plantations, and then into quite dense forest, coming eventually to a mystic glade, where a massive central menhir, shaped at its sides, coming to a point like an obelisk, juts 3 meters straight up out of the earth. It is surrounded by a ring of smaller menhirs, some fallen, some still standing, and round about there are huge numbers of further worked stones, many with patterns of cupules carved into them very similar to the cupules at Karahantepe in Turkey. Tugu Gede has been the subject of some cursory excavations, but there appears to be no clear consensus on its antiquity. The megaliths themselves are accepted as prehistoric, thousands of years old, although exactly how many thousands no one seems to know. But there are also later occupation layers that have yielded up pottery and artifacts that are only a few hundred years old. And of course the site stands close to, and is impacted by, human settlements to this day. One of the most anomalous finds is a small statue. On no very good grounds, archaeologists suppose it to be a representation of the Hindu god Shiva, but it bears no resemblance to any images of Shiva that I've seen, and to my eye at least, looks much more like a crudely worked ancient Egyptian figure with its crossed hands and distinctive headdress. Mainstream archaeology does not believe that the ancient Egyptians could have reached Indonesia, so this possibility has never been considered. However, there is compelling evidence that long-distance oceanic voyages were undertaken from Egypt during pharaonic times. For example, the presence in 9 mummies dated between 1070 BC and AD 395 of cocaine and tobacco, both indigenous American plants not previously thought to have been present in the Old World before the time of Columbus. These findings by S. Balabanova, F. Parsh, and W. Persig have been disputed by other scholars who regard long-distance ancient Egyptian sea voyages as a priori impossible. According to Egyptologist John Baines, for example, the idea that the Egyptians should have travelled to America is overall absurd. And I also don't know anyone who spends time doing research in these areas because they're not perceived to be areas that have any real meaning for the subject. The way I see it, however, this comment by Baines is more indicative of a deep-seated problem within Egyptology itself and within archaeology in general than of a problem in the factual findings of Balabanova et al. Archaeology is too much constrained by a rigid reference frame of what is possible and what is not, and tends to ignore, sidestep, or ridicule evidence that challenges that reference frame. This is equally true when it comes to the case for a lost civilization of the Ice Age, which again is dismissed on no good grounds other than that it is considered to be a priori impossible. Meanwhile, since the validity of Balabanova's findings has subsequently been vindicated, and therefore we must assume the ancient Egyptians did indeed make voyages as far as the Americas, I see no good reason to ignore the possibility that they also made voyages in the other direction, eastwards towards Indonesia and beyond. Indeed, ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions, though once again disputed, have been found at a wilderness site near the town of Gosford, to the north of Sydney in eastern Australia. I have had the opportunity to study these glyphs myself, and do not agree with the mainstream view that they can easily be dismissed as 20th century hoaxes. On the contrary, a recent October 2014 deciphering of the glyphs by hieroglyphics experts Mohammed Ibrahim and Yusuf Abdel Hakim Aiwan concluded, "Not only are the Gosford glyphs legitimate, the scribes accurately used several ancient hieroglyphs and grammatical variations which, crucially, were not even documented in Egyptian hieroglyphic texts until 2012, immediately disproving all long-standing hoax theories. The specific style of hieroglyphs used also provides a linguistic time frame that places an Egyptian presence in Australia at least 2,500 years ago, while the translated text is even so detailed as to identify the ancient scribes by name and occupation." I'm not claiming that the case is settled yet. The Gosford glyphs may or may not be a hoax. Much more work needs to be done to settle the matter. My point, however, is that the use by Orthodox archaeologists of a priori assumptions about what happened in the past as a reason not to conduct wide-ranging investigations into what actually did happen in the past is poor scholarship. In my view, therefore, rather than simply ruling out the possibility that the ancient Egyptians might have reached not only the Americas, but also Indonesia and Australia, we should be asking ourselves why and over what sort of time span they might have made such voyages. In particular, I wonder if it is possible that the tradition of a drowned homeland of the gods somewhere in the East that is so strongly expressed in the Edfu building texts might be connected to this mystery. To be specific, could Indonesia, once part of the mainland of Southeast Asia, and broken up into more than 13,000 islands by cataclysmic sea level rise at the end of the Ice Age, and perhaps particularly Java with its 45 active volcanoes, have been associated in the ancient Egyptian mind with the Isle of Fire, which R.T. Rundle Clark describes as the mystic land of origin beyond the horizon? The very same Isle of Fire, as we saw in Chapter 11, from which Hike, the vital magical essence, was brought by the Phoenix to Heliopolis, the symbolic center and navel of the earth. The Isle of Fire, with which Horus of Edfu was directly associated, and where Thoth, the sage, the lord of wisdom, made shrines for the gods and goddesses. The final leg of our 2014 Indonesia journey takes us back to Gunung Padang, the mysterious pyramid for so long thought to be a natural hill that geologist Dani Natwijaja, through determined efforts, has brought to the attention of the world. I won't describe it again since I've already introduced it to the reader in Chapter 2. We've seen how the megalithic site of columnar basalt, visible on the uppermost terraces of Gunung Padang, is simply the latest episode in its long story, and how Danny and his team used seismic tomography, ground-penetrating radar, and other remote sensing technologies to show that the man-made structures go down tens of meters beneath the surface. Core drilling into these buried structures was undertaken, producing organic materials with impeccable provenance that yielded ever more ancient carbon dates extending back ultimately to more than 22,000 years ago, before the end of the last ice age, when our ancestors are supposed, according to the Orthodox archaeological model, to have been nothing more than primitive hunter-gatherers, incapable of large-scale construction and engineering feats. Intriguingly, as I also reported in Chapter 2, the remote sensing equipment flagged up the presence deep within the pyramid of what appeared to be three hidden chambers, so rectilinear in form